The parent argues that the marriage would cause inconvenience or less revenue to the family household, or that she is too delicate to be left alone, so the boy, through a sense of duty, gives up the chance of a happy marriage and selflessly devotes his life to looking after the selfish parent. He does not always realize that the parent is selfish, though it is a fact for anyone to see. The karmic result of such selfishness is that it must be considered as only fair, if in a future life this woman would fall in love with someone, only for that person to die, or be killed, before the marriage could take place. After many years, recovering from this loss, this same woman finds that another individual has fallen in love with her. There appear to be no reasons why things should not work out right on this occasion, but fate may again take a hand in the game of life, with the result that one of the contracting parties develops an incurable disease, which puts marriage out of the question. As people do not know the reason behind such happenings, they are inclined to think that the person concerned is a plaything of an unkind creator, but such is not the case, for you cannot suffer in any way unless you yourself have produced the cause for that suffering. Q. Why are some people born under a lucky star with plenty of money, good health and every seeming advantage, whereas others are born in the slums, with no natural advantages, and often with diseases inherited from their parents? A. The environment into which every man is born is made by himself in a previous incarnation, also in accordance with the law of karma. When a man is born under what you call a lucky star with lots of money and perfect health, the world naturally feels that he has indeed been blessed by a divine providence. But this opportunity of an easy life is only accorded to one who deserves it. The man who is born in the slums, with many limitations and perhaps hereditary disease, is considered unfortunate. But I can assure you that he too has earned what he receives. To find an instance of a man who has earned the right to be born with a silver spoon in his mouth, you have only to look amongst the poor people of the world to find examples of this kind. How often have you seen generosity displayed by an individual who is not blessed with many of this world's goods, but nevertheless goes out of his way to assist others less fortunate than himself? Such a person is only too often taken advantage of by unscrupulous people. Generous actions such as these people perform earn for them the right to be born in very different circumstances in a future existence, and they very seldom lose the opportunities which great wealth provides, for they continue to help their fellow men as they did in the past, with benefit to themselves and the world. If these opportunities are wasted, then the man makes bad karma instead of good, and it would have been better for him had he been born into circumstances less favorable from a worldly point of view. It is not necessarily a great misfortune for a man to be born in humble circumstances. In such cases, he has the opportunity to overcome the limitations of his environment through his own efforts. We often see such men surmount the obstacles of their birth and emerge successful, even leaders of their generations. It takes courage to do this, yet the efforts made not only improve a man's character, but enable him to make much good karma in that incarnation. His efforts and his refusal to be deterred by those natural limitations will usually ensure that, in the life to follow, his environment will be much more favorable. Q. Can you explain why some races are born with colored skins and others with white skins? Is a man with a white skin always more evolved than a man with a colored skin? Is it a good thing for individuals of different races to marry? Is a white man ever reborn into a colored race once he has inhabited a white body? A. From a spiritual point of view, there is no reason to suppose that a white skin is necessarily better than a colored skin. The color of a man's skin does not denote his standing in evolution. It is usually due to the climate prevailing in the country in which he is born. The question of which nation a man will be born into is usually decided for him, though the ego is given a certain amount of choice. Before his return to physical life begins, the ego is shown the particular characteristics which he lacks, and, because each nation has special characteristics of its own, expressed by practically all the members of that nation, An ego is usually born as a child of a family forming part of a nation whose predominant virtues and characteristics that ego lacks, in order that these may be built into his future structure. Many thousands of years ago, the parts of this planet which were principally inhabited by men were the countries where you now find the indigenous people having colored skins. Although Australia is today a white man's country, the Aborigines of Australia were black men. In South Africa, the original inhabitants were dark-skinned people, and although there are large numbers of these still living, South Africa today is controlled by the white man. All of us have in our early incarnations occupied dark-skinned bodies. As civilization advanced, the countries now known as the West became inhabited, and in order that these countries should be developed as quickly as possible, the perfected men who supervise the rise and fall of nations arranged for some of the more advanced egos in the world to be born as children of the pioneers who inhabited Western countries. Because the climate in these countries was generally much colder than the climate in the Eastern countries, the sun had less effect on the skin of all these individuals, with the result that white races came into being. Progress today emanates mostly from Western nations, and because of that, it is desirable that the most experienced men in the world, the older souls, should be born in Western bodies. Great Britain has been the strong nation for the past century or more and has therefore received her due quota of advanced egos, but now America is taking over the responsibilities of that difficult position. It is certainly not chance which decides whether a man is born an Englishman, an American, a German or a Chinese. It must be obvious to you that all men with white skins are not more evolved than all men with colored skins. Every nation in the world requires a certain number of experienced and evolved egos to lead it and help with its progress in evolution, so a certain number of old souls are always born into every nation. p. 130. By this I do not mean that old souls would ever be born into bodies which we know of as Australian Aborigines. It would be impossible for this to be so, because they are not a nation, they are a dying race. Thus the only entities which inhabit these bodies are those who were originally members of that race, but who have not advanced as quickly or progressed as far as the other original members of the race who have passed on to other races long since. Contrast India with this. In that country you find millions of unevolved beings, but you also find a large number of intellectual, advanced beings and many extremely spiritually minded men. India has always been a country whose inhabitants thought a great deal about spiritual development. Believe me, it has an ancient culture, and it will also play a great part in the progress of the world in centuries to come. Obviously, it is necessary for such a country to have egos born into it who can guide the destiny of its countless millions, so that in future years it can play the part allotted to it. Whether individuals of different races should marry is a difficult question to decide. It may sometimes happen that individuals who are born into different nations have been linked in past lives, through marriage for example. When these people meet in this life, as members of different nations, the attraction which drew them together in the past may still be as strong as before. In some cases it might be advantageous for such people to marry again, only by investigating the individual past experiences of both parties could one give an opinion that would be of value. I feel though that usually it is most undesirable for white men to marry colored women, or the reverse, for the habits and culture of the different races do not mix well, therefore such a marriage does not work out to the advantage of either person. The result may also be that half-caste children are brought into the world, and it is apparent to everyone that these suffer from the accident of their birth. A man who is born in a white body does not necessarily return to Earth as a member of a white population in his next incarnation. This again is a matter of karma and of many circumstances, so that no general reply can be given to a question of this sort. In the case of a white man who, through a feeling of superiority, exploited other members of the human race, merely because they had colored skins, the law of cause and effect would come into action. He would probably be forced to be born into a colored race in his next incarnation, so that he might learn the lessons of tolerance and understanding, which he obviously lacked in his former existence. Q, you have not said what happens to a man who commits suicide. Is such an act a great crime? A, the taking of one's own life is not only a crime, but is also an extremely foolish act. You do not solve your difficulties by running away from them, but merely postpone their solution for a future life. A man would argue that the circumstances which he has to face are the cause of his getting out of life, whereas they are the circumstances which have been judged necessary for his progress in evolution, and he must go through them sooner or later. In exactly the same way that a child who plays truant from school will be kept back in the lower form for another term, and until he has realized that in order to qualify for a higher form he must obtain at least a minimum number of marks in all subjects. So when the man who commits suicide returns to the world in his next life, a group of circumstances will again arise, forming exactly the same obstacles and difficulties from which he now runs away. He must then face them and overcome them, for if he runs away once more, he is merely delaying his own evolution, and until he has faced and overcome these obstacles and thus learned the lessons they were meant to teach him, he cannot advance any further on the journey towards perfection. Extreme remorse usually follows an act of suicide, and within a very short time of their arrival in the astral world, the majority of suicides would give anything to undo their action. Unfortunately, they cannot go back, but must wait until the time arrives for their next incarnation, and they are left in no doubt whatever that in their next life they will have to face the same difficulties again. Because the man suffers so much from remorse and because he would give anything to get back into his physical body, even though it would mean facing up to the consequences, he often refuses to make the effort of will necessary for him to get rid of his etheric vehicle, which you will remember winds itself round the astral body at the moment of death. On account of this clinging of the etheric vehicle, he is what is known as earthbound just so long as he remains obstinate and refuses to get rid of it. Being a suicide, he does not get the same sympathetic help from the astral helpers as you have seen is selflessly given to all who pass to the next world in the normal way. Thus he may remain earthbound through ignorance, being unable to function properly either in the physical or in the astral world, feeling the extreme loneliness that exists under these circumstances. After a period which seems like an eternity, he will, through a changed state of mind, draw towards him a helping hand, after which he can commence his life under astral conditions. Apostrophe the exceedingly unpleasant conditions ruling in that no man's land sometimes make a man bitter against his creator and mankind in general, that he wanders about the place where he took his life, trying to influence other people to do the same thing. The reason for this is the awful loneliness of his present condition, and he feels that if he can persuade others to do what he has done, he will not be entirely alone in his misery. On very rare occasions he succeeds in his efforts, and the karmic result of such a deed means that he must suffer greatly in the life that is to come. Suicide is never a release, only a postponement, and no circumstances in the world are so bad that a man should resort to such methods of evading them. Q, if there is a god or deity controlling our lives, why does he allow wars, particularly as the majority of mankind desire peace? A, why do you suggest that wars are made, or allowed to be, by a creator? Wars are quite definitely the result of man's actions and his aggressive tendencies. There will be wars so long as there are separate nations in the world, and while some nations wish to rule and exploit other nations. There is national karma as well as individual karma, and the groups of people who have banded themselves together as a specific nation and have interfered with the life of another nation must always bear the consequences of such actions, whether good or bad. In many cases, a nation will argue that it meant well for the peoples whom it conquered, but history has usually proved that a conquered nation never quite settles down under the heel of a conqueror, nor can it evolve as quickly as when it is left alone to work out its own salvation. Wars beget wars, and so it will be, until mankind realizes that all members of the human race are members of the same human family, who should be treated with sympathy and understanding and be given help as a matter of course. In due time there will be no separate nations, for all men will live in harmony together, each group exchanging with others the things which the part of the world in which they live can most easily produce, together with the manufactured articles which their training has enabled them to perfect. Separate nations will then become merely states in a world nation, and wise men, drawn from each group, will govern and legislate for the good of all. It is quite true that the majority of men desire peace, but unfortunately peace or war is usually decided by those who happen to be in power at the moment. The responsibility of any nation or any group of men for launching a war such as we are passing through at the moment, is great indeed, and it is seldom, if ever, that such a war can be justified, whatever the arguments may be that are put forward in an endeavor to prove that there was no other way out. The world will soon realize that even the nations, which win modem wars, lose in the end, and after a war the conditions ruling in the world are so difficult, that any advantages they seem to gain are outweighed by the post-war problems they must face. Never think that wars are desired by the powers that control creation. These perfected men do everything in their power to lead humanity along the paths of peace and progress, but their efforts are limited, because man has been granted free will. That is his peculiar heritage as a member of the human kingdom. When people are very evolved, do they automatically achieve the continuity of consciousness which enables them to remember what they must do whilst out of their bodies during sleep? My answer depends on what you conceive to be an evolved man. The average man has from 500 to 600 incarnations in different bodies, during the time that elapses between his first to his last life as a human being, having then passed the fifth initiation and become an adept. Although about 600 lives are usually necessary to learn all the lessons that this world has to teach, it is only during the last 50 lives or so that a man develops occultly and learns to use the faculties latent in all men, such as intuition, clairvoyance, and the power consciously to get out of his body, whenever the necessity arises. For all general purposes, you can assume that an evolved man has developed these faculties. But it is possible for one not so evolved to be given the opportunity of developing along this particular line, and your own case should serve to illustrate my point. You probably have more than 50 incarnations in front of you, before you reach the stage of a perfect man, but because your need was great, you have been granted special tuition, and in return I hope that you will show your gratitude by passing on this knowledge to others less fortunate than yourself. If you continue to work as you are working now, you will find that your memory of what happens to you when you are out of your body becomes clearer and clearer, and your knowledge of the life beyond the grave will enable you to progress much more quickly than is usual. At the same time, it will bring you much peace and contentment of mind. Do not imagine that having been able to develop this faculty, you are different from, or superior to, many others who probably would have welcomed a similar opportunity to yours. Pride is always a danger, for it is often responsible for help being withdrawn from an individual, with the result that such a man falls back into the slough of despondence. Are we born an equal number of times as men and women, or is sex just chance? Your last question is an easy one. No. Sex is not just chance, and we are not born an equal number of times as men and women. It is only possible to develop certain characteristics in female bodies and others in male bodies. By the time we reach perfection, we shall all have developed to a minimum extent all the virtues that add up to the ideal of a perfect man, and much more than a minimum in some of them. A man who develops through action naturally is a different character from one who develops through leading a saintly life and through a capacity to meditate for long periods in an endeavor to help his fellow man. All types of perfected beings are necessary, and many are the ways taken by us to fulfill our destiny. If an individual should lack courage and the capacity to make sound decisions and to rule faithfully over his fellow man, it would probably mean that such a person might have to be born in a male body for 2 or 3 consecutive lives, so that he would have ample opportunity for the development he needed. If, on the other hand, an individual lacked the instinct called maternal, or even paternal, and also was incapable of that selfless devotion and capacity to love a person, even when that love was spurned, it would probably mean that a life or two in a female body would be desirable, so that these lessons might be learned. In theory, one should inhabit the same number of male and female bodies in the total number of lives which we live, but in practice it does not work out that way, for some people develop more easily in one type of body than they do in the other. In due time, when a man reaches perfection, he should have all the outstanding qualities of both sexes reasonably well developed. When you have an opportunity of meeting some of these perfected men, you will find that what I have told you is indeed true. Acharya continued, "This brings me to the end of your questions, and after you have transcribed your shorthand notes and read them through, I hope you will find that the answers I have given clarify the points you have raised. If I were you, I should have a nearly night, for you must be tired, and I would not bother about concentrating before going to sleep on remembering in the morning what you did tonight. I shall not visit you again for at least a week, so you will have plenty of opportunity to experiment on your own, and as I told you yesterday, if you get into any difficulty, I shall be near, to help you. Peace be with you, my son. I will leave you now." I could give a long description of the many incidents which took place the following week, but instead I shall summarize the highlights. On the very first night I managed to make my way to Daphne's cottage, where I found her entertaining friends. I was introduced to and had interesting conversations with several of them on current events in the world, on which topics I found them to be very well informed. Several movie films were shown for my benefit, depicting the gardens attached to the bungalows in this valley. These gardens were much more beautiful than any I had seen before. When gardens were shown which were not laid out in any way, I saw nature spirits, tiny people who couldn't be much more than 5 to 6 inches high, judging by comparison with the flowers I knew, dancing in and out of the pictures. When they lighted on a flower, the stem gave a slight tremor, as it would be if a large butterfly or bumblebee did the same thing. They are indeed perfect replicas of the fairies described in the books beloved by children of all ages, with one important difference: the complete absence of wings, and this can be understood, for logically wings are quite unnecessary at the level where these nature spirits exist. On the second night I got out of my body, meaning to visit the third sphere once more, but when I found myself hovering immediately above the bed on which my body was lying, the first thing I heard was the voice of Charles speaking to me in characteristic army dialect. He said, "It's about time you looked me up. I've been here at least 3 times since the night when you and your Indian friend came to London with me. Each time your old body was here, but you had gone. I didn't know where you had pushed off to, so I couldn't follow you. This time I decided to come early so as to be sure to catch you." "My dear Charles," I said, "I'm terribly sorry. I didn't know you had been looking for me, for I have been exceedingly busy and very interested indeed in all that I have seen. What about going up to your little turret room, which I remember used to be a favorite of yours?" said Charles. "Then we can have a long talk, just like old times."
"Good idea, old chap, let's go." So we went up to my sanctum where we chatted over old days, and I told him more or less everything that had happened to me up to date. Charles said, "I'm damned glad you've been so lucky as to meet Acharya, for it worried me after I died to see how extremely depressed and miserable you were. I tried my damnedest, my best, to speak to you, but couldn't make you hear. We had been jolly good pals in the old days, even though I always looked on you as donkey's years older than me. I appreciate all you've done for me ever since the days when you started to teach me football, and gave me my first lesson in how to hold a bat. What a funny thing life is. My idea used to be more or less to have a good time and get the best out of life that I could, and possibly later to marry some nice girl and have a family. When I first met Acharya, he impressed me with the fact that a man doesn't change after death. It is the conditions under which he lives that are different, and I have found that quite true." "Yes," I replied, I gathered from Acharya that you had not been exactly miserable. He said you had linked up with some girl who had recently left the world. Is that so? Did he blush or was I imagining it?
Yes, that's true enough, said Charles. I think it passes the time to have a girl pal to wander round with. In her case I'm afraid it tickles my vanity, for she thinks I'm a hell of a fellow, just because I know a little more than she does. She didn't have a very good time in the world, so I suppose this moving around, seeing shows and going to restaurants is thrilling for a time.
Oh, Charles, I said, there's one thing I want to ask you. Is there any sex relationship at your level after you've dropped the physical body? This time I'm quite sure he blushed but he went on, well yes, there is of a kind, and I think most people indulge in it, but it's not quite the same thing as on the physical plane. One leads up to things in the same way, and although I would probably have felt just as shy about talking of my secret love affairs, had you asked me the same question before I died, I suppose I feel just a wee bit shy of talking about these things now. I said, I didn't mean to be personal, I'm just interested in getting as much information as I can about the differences between conditions in the physical and the astral worlds and at various levels of the latter. I told you about my coming up against Daphne on one of the higher levels, where she is already studying music. I was very much in love with Daphne when she was alive and would have I asked her to marry me as soon as I was able to support a wife. Although we never experienced the physical relationship of marriage, I feel that the platonic association we shall carry on now at these higher levels will not only last through our astral existence but will be of great benefit to us in our next incarnation. What about coming along with me one night and letting me introduce you to Daphne? P137.
Yes, I'd like to, said Charles. I suggested a date for Thursday night, to which he agreed. Charles said he had recently made contact with our father, who had died some years previously. From his description I gathered that father was living at the second sphere. Charles described how he had found him surrounded by rose bushes. This was as I had known him in my boyhood days. He said that the last time he had seen him, father was distressed because a Scotch terrier which had attached itself to him had suddenly disappeared and he felt it had been lost. I explained to Charles what had really happened, but he showed little interest. We talked on till a peculiar feeling of restlessness came over me. I had just time to say to Charles not to forget Thursday when I woke in my bed with no remembrance of how I got there. It was on Wednesday night I had a most disturbing experience, a nightmare in which Daphne took part. It seemed that Daphne and I were in a dark cave. For some reason we could not escape from a loathsome gorilla-like creature who was seated on the floor close to us, glowering at Daphne who obviously attracted it in some horrible way. I know that in my dream I wanted to protect Daphne, but the gorilla was of such a size and strength that I knew I would have no chance against it. It seemed highly amused at our efforts to escape, for it emitted wild yells and hoarse laughter as we ran hither and thither around the cave, trying to find an exit. Even in my dreams, sweat poured from my brow and I tried to think of Acharya in the hope he would come to our assistance, but nothing happened and we seemed left to our fate. After a little time the gorilla rose to its feet and advanced towards Daphne, whom it grasped with its horrible long hairy arms and commenced to drag her to the other end of the cave. Daphne screamed and resisted to the best of her ability, and in desperation I hurled myself at the horrible creature and, although I had no weapon, I endeavored to get my hands on its throat, in the hope that it would turn its attentions to me. Even now, I can still smell the fetid breath of the brute, for in the middle of the fight I awoke in my bed, sweating profusely and with the bedclothes all tangled about me. I haven't the slightest idea what it all means. I shall check up with Daphne as soon as possible in the hope she knows something about it. Thursday was the night I began my career as an astral helper. This was the night on which I had arranged to take Charles to the third sphere. Charles was late, and when he arrived he was in an agitated condition because, he said, a pal of his, Bill Fletcher, had just crashed and been killed in a raid over London.
He asked me to come with him and help, so we set out at once for London. Charles knew where to look for Bill, and our assistance was welcomed by three inexperienced but eager astral helpers. After about 2 hours' hard work on the part of all of us, Bill was persuaded to make the effort of will to free himself from his etheric body, and at once became quite a different person. Charles and I took charge of him. We went with him to his home, where we did what we could to prepare his young wife for the news she would receive the following morning.